Hare Krishna. Today we'll do the chapter summary for chapter 7 and chapter 8. And I mean, there's a lot happening in those chapters, so I've been given 1 hour time for this. I might go a little over time, but I'll try to finish faster since all of us have heard the classes before. So diving into chapter 7. So the summary is that the first, like from 1 to 7, Srila Vyasadeva's, like description of Srila Vyasadeva's meditation and his samadhi and his realizations. Text 8 to 11 is Vyasadeva teaches the Bhagavatam to Sukadeva Goswami. And text 12 to 40 is Arjun, you know, the Mahabharata story starts where Krishna, you know, that's the first introduction we get of Krishna. And that's Arjuna is capturing Ashwatthama. And then text 41 to 58 is the punishment of Ashwatthama. Moving to texts 1 to 7, which describe about the samadhi of Vyasadeva and his realization. And the most important Bhagavatam verses, texts 4, 5, 6 and 7 lie in this particular section. So moving back a little bit, so we're talking about chapter 7 right now. So in chapters 5 and 6, you know, we heard about how Vyasadeva is a little, you know, he's a little distressed. He's not feeling satisfied even after composing so many literatures. And then his Gurudev Narad Muni comes over there and tells him that, you know, unless he glorifies Lord Krishna's pastimes directly, only then he will feel the satisfaction in his heart. And that is the only way of, you know, really serving all the souls outside. So Vyasadeva, and then Narad Muni also shares in chapter 6, he shares his own story. He shares how by association with the Bhaktivedantas and then his mother and then the services that they did and then how he gets darshan of the Lord. And then he speaks about his past life and how he cultivates and then now how he's like free, just like the air, just because of performing devotional service to the Lord, he's free to move anywhere. So all that happens and then Narad Muni departs. And then so Shaunaka Rishi asks Suta Goswami, you know, so Vyasadeva got all these instructions from Narad Muni. And what does he do after getting all of these instructions from Narad Muni? You know, what are Srila Vyasadeva's activities after Narada's departure? I mean, this is a very big thing, right? Now, like, you know, Narad Muni has given him all the instructions and now he's departed. So what does Vyasadeva do with all that he has received? You know, the potency that has been invested in him, what does he do with that? So there are verses talking about that. And the essence is that Vyasadeva, he concentrates his mind and he fully aligns himself in bhakti yoga. And he concentrates his mind in, I think this is putting pressure on me. Thank you. So Vyasadeva concentrates his mind as Narad Muni had directed, fully linking himself in the process of bhakti yoga, sitting in a yogic pose, and he is meditating by the river bank. And in his meditation, because he's been invested with the instructions and the potency of Narad Muni, in his meditation he sees five different things. And what he sees in his meditation is what he motivates him to write the Srimad Bhagavatam. That forms the essence of the entire Srimad Bhagavatam. So these verses 4, 5, 6 and 7 are Srimad Bhagavatam in a nutshell. And they are the most important verses. And these explain Vyasadeva's meditation and realization based on which he writes the Srimad Bhagavatam. And more importantly, he also sees Krishna's very intimate pastimes that happen in Vrindavan. And it's only because he sees them in that meditation is he able to write them and compose them in the 10th canto. So now the next slide is about what Vyasadeva sees in his meditation. So he sees the absolute truth Krishna. He sees Krishna in his full, you know, in his form, and he's able to like understand he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Then he sees the Lord's Antaranga Shakti, complete with all the Vrindavan pastimes. So he sees all of these different Vrindavan pastimes that we see here, you know, the different rasas, the different interactions, the different intimate dealings with all the very, very exalted devotees in Vrindavan. Then he sees the Lord, then he sees his internal potency, his very attractive internal potency. Then he also sees the Bahiranga Shakti, you know, the entire, you know, Durga Devi, the Bahiranga Shakti, which is completely in control of the Lord. So what he sees is he sees the absolute truth, then he sees his internal potency, and then he sees that, oh, the same person also controls, you know, everything else that's there around us. And then he sees the Tatastha Shakti. That is, he sees the living entities who are completely struggling with the modes of material nature. You know, they're completely struggling with their bodily identification. They're completely struggling with all the designations that they carry. They completely are struggling with all the different attractions and attachments that they have. And I think somewhere in the Srimad Bhagavatam there is a shloka that a person who is chained, you know, when a person is chained, he's just trying to like move about everywhere and, you know, try to do different things. But a person who's released from the chains is very peaceful, very happy and very calm. So the living entity is caught on in the modes of material nature, and the modes of material nature are like pushing him in different places, and he's becoming a puppet in their hands. But one who releases himself from that by the process of bhakti yoga, you know, is very situated, very calm, very happy, very peaceful, and is able to perform very loving devotional service to the Lord. So the tatastha shakti, the living entity, is the marginal and like they're on the fence, so they're struggling with the modes of material nature. And I found this another thing I heard in Burijan Prabhu's lecture is that, you know, all these things are so deeply rooted that they keep us rooted. They don't allow us to fully experience devotional service of the Lord. I mean, even if you just think about it, if you're reading Srimad Bhagavatam or you're attending say today's Pandav Nirjal Ekadasi, I mean, I'm talking for myself here, and I have certain plans of what I want to do, and, you know, Nirjal Ekadashi, I should be reading, hearing, chanting and all. But my body is not, you know, after a while, I know I'll get tired. I know I won't be able to do certain things. I'll feel thirsty, I'll feel hungry, I'll feel giddy after some time. And, you know, my body is going to limit my functions of devotional service. And also if we, like, so many times on the subtle level also, so many of our desires, so many of our attachments, they limit our, you know, limit full-blown devotional service to the Lord, because then I have the anarthas in my heart and they block me from, you know, fully giving myself, fully surrendering myself. So what Burijan Prabhu was saying in the class is that, you know, we are deeply rooted like that, like a tree. We're so deeply rooted and the, you know, the roots run so deep, it's very difficult to come out, and it can be only cut done, like only the roots can be only cut by the process of devotional service. And then he compares that with Narad Muni, who's like the air. Is free to move anywhere, singing the glories of the Lord, doing devotional service, inspiring, you know, doing all the different preaching, right from Gopal's garden to Varishtha Vaishnavas, you know, like from the children, he's preaching not only to the children, but he's also preaching to the senior grihasthas and everyone. It's like he's doing everything. He's preaching to the youth, the prachetas, then he's preaching to the grihasthas, he's preaching to the senior Vaishnavas and all the different ashrams. So that is our aspiration. And this particular analogy also reminds me of when we were doing the festival of sacred chants on, I think it was the first festival of sacred chants we did in October last year. And we had these Iranian performers, like Harivalas Prabhu's friends, come in and sing different chants and different prayers by their poet Rumi. And one of the entire songs was the conversation. I mean, I didn't understand, of course, because they were speaking in Persian, they were singing in Persian, but the Rumi's poetry is very metaphorical. And like when they introduced it, they said that this is a conversation between the freely moving wind and a very deeply rooted tree that is found in the desert. And how the tree is like lamenting, you know, hey, I also wish to be like you. You know, I also wish to be free to chant the, you know, the prayers and the glories of the Lord, but I'm so deeply rooted, you know, please tell me how I can become like you. So this is across different traditions, and something like this is understood across different traditions. So what Vyasadeva is seeing is that he sees the Antaranga Shakti, he sees that, wow, this is so attractive. And then he sees the, you know, wow, this is so attractive, you know, the residents of Vrindavan are performing such high grade of devotional service so lovingly and, you know, completely given themselves. And then he sees, you know, he feels compassion when he sees these living entities struggling so much. You know, they're struggling so much. So for him, it's like a contrast, you know, like, oh, why are they like this? You know, I want to help them so that they can also experience the full-blown devotional service to the Lord. And then in his meditation, he also sees the means of deliverance. And what is the means of deliverance? Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya. So he sees that, you know, by constantly hearing from a bona fide devotee of the Lord in the parampara, we constantly hear the Srimad Bhagavatam from them in the association of devotees, then we will be able to, then the living entity will be delivered from these different modes of material nature and be able to serve the Lord. Because if he performs bhakti yoga, he will also be able to overcome, you know, the Bahiranga Shakti, because that is completely in the control of the Lord. So this is what Vyasadeva sees, and I was very fortunate to find Harivalas Prabhu's picture also. I was just searching on Google Images for Srimad Bhagavatam class, and I scrolled down a little bit and I found this picture of Harivilas Prabhu from the Mayapur website. So I said, okay, we'll put it here. So Srila Prabhupada has given us this process, you know. He has this process of Nityam Bhagavat Sevaya. And we have, you know, by the grace of all the devotees who are recording the lectures, putting them up, uploading them, we have all the Vani available in ether. We have it all available in the internet. And we also have the books of Srila Prabhupada. So it is only up to us. And Vyasadev has, like, you know, he's so much compassion he has put into it. So as a matter of gratitude, we should try to read Srimad Bhagavatam every day, and we should try to hear Srimad Bhagavatam constantly. Like Amritanand Prabhu, I know he hears 3-4 lectures a day. It's always on, continuously on, and he keeps hearing the same lectures 3-4 times. He said, because I might have missed something. So that is my inspiration. If I can just hear like Amritanand Prabhu every day like that, I guess I'll also be able to serve the Lord very nicely by the mercy of all the devotees. So this is what Vyasadeva sees in his meditation, and that's what motivates him, and that's what he writes in the Srimad Bhagavatam. And again, I'll just stress on this, because he sees the Lord's pastimes in Vrindavan, he is able to write those down in the 10th canto. So otherwise, he wouldn't have been able to, because he sees it in this meditation, the internal energy and all the pastimes in Vrindavan. So we've just finished the first section, which was about Vyasadeva's meditation and realization, and then his motivation. And then the text 8 to 11, it starts with Shaunak Rishi asking Suta Goswami. Like, they hear, okay, this is Vyasadeva's meditation. And then Shaunak Rishi asks, like, you know, why did someone as self-satisfied as Sukadev Goswami have to study Srimad Bhagavatam? So basically, Shaunak Rishi is asking the question so that we can glorify the Srimad Bhagavatam a little bit more and feel the glorification in our heart and feel the impetus to, you know, dive deeper into Srimad Bhagavatam. So Suta Goswami, you know, this is some story, like a little bit of a story also over here. So Vyasadev teaches the Srimad Bhagavatam to his son Sukadev Goswami. But Sukadev Goswami was an Atmaram. He had no material desires. He was completely self-satisfied being in the womb in that position for 16 years. And Vyasadeva got very worried. Why is he not coming out? You know? So the story goes, and I mean, y'all can correct me if I'm missing something here, but the story goes that Sukadev Goswami causes Vyasadeva to go all the way to Dwarka, bring Lord Krishna, and then he says, I'll come out of the womb only if I get a lot assurance from Lord Krishna himself that Maya will not touch me. So he's so satisfied in the womb, you know, all the functions are dormant, you know, he's just so happy meditating in the womb itself. He has no desire to come out, and he comes out only when Lord Krishna gives him the promise that Maya will not touch you. But as soon as he comes out, you know, much to Vyasadeva's despair, he just walks out. He just leaves, and Vyasadeva is like crying out and all, and only the trees can hear. We went through that part earlier. So he just walks out of the house. And then Vyasadeva sends two messengers after him. He sends two of his disciples, you know, to attract him. Because if Vyasadeva goes, may not come. But then he sends two of his messengers. And they sing these two very, very exquisite Srimad Bhagavatam verses. And y'all can look it up later on. Which is 3.2.23 and 10.21.5. And these verses describe Lord Krishna's immense compassion and Lord Krishna's immense, imperceivable beauty. And when a self-satisfied soul, a person who has no material desires at all, and he is completely on the most elevated, he is completely on that Brahman platform, he is an Atmaram, he is completely happy within himself, when he hears those verses, he gets so attracted that he walks back. Imagine, someone is 16 years in the womb, very happy sitting in the womb in that position. It's very hard to be in that position for, I mean, if we just sleep in that position for a very long time, you know, we wake up with a lot of aches and pains. But he's so satisfied, he's just very happy being in that position. So someone at that level, when he hears Srimad Bhagavatam, such an exalted level, when he hears Srimad Bhagavatam, he gets attracted. So then, who are we not to read the Srimad Bhagavatam? Or not to find it attractive? Or even if we don't find it attractive, we should just read it because, you know, someone as self-satisfied as Sukadev Goswami found it attractive. So those two verses captivate Sukadev Goswami's mind. And he returns home enticed by the desire to hear the Srimad Bhagavatam his father had composed. Now there are some technical details here about which Sukadev Goswami came back and which, you know, one remained a brahmachari and one became a grahastha and also. I won't get into the details of that story right now. But this is the essence of these three verses. So Now text 8 to 11, so we just came to, like, we just saw that in 4, 5 and 6 and 7 are like very important shlokas of the Bhagavatam. And so is text 10 in the 7th chapter, and that is called as the Atmarama shloka. And Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu explains this shloka and gives 18 different meanings of this shloka to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. And when Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya hears those different 18 meanings, like Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya is also very accomplished. So when he hears those different 18 meanings coming from the Lord, he surrenders to the Lord thinking that yes, you know, only the Supreme Personality of Godhead can do something like that. Somewhere I also heard that Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu explained in 64 different ways to Keshav Kashmiri, or I don't remember who. Okay, but I just read that, I don't know, in Burijan Prabhu's book I saw 18, but in his lecture I heard 64, so I was a little confused, I thought I'll ask you. So the essence is that those who are already self-satisfied, you know, there's a lot, I mean, I haven't, I may consider, oh, I'm self-satisfied, but I haven't realized myself as a soul. I still identify with the body and my false ego. So, but the self, so it's very, very, very elevated platform. Like Sukadeva Goswami was in a very, very elevated platform to have identified himself as a soul. And he identified as a soul who's situated in eternality. And in even in that existence, they're so self-satisfied, they have no hankering, nothing. You know, I may go Artho Jigyasu Artharthi, you know, I may go for these different reasons to Srimad Bhagavatam. But Sukadeva Goswami has none of those pangs, completely satisfied. And even they become attracted to Krishna. Because the Lord's Naam, Roop, Guna and Leela are all very, very attractive. And the way Srila Prabhupada says that is that, we'll read Prabhupada's section of the purport. So, by his personal features and transcendental attributes, the Lord attracts all psychological activities of a pure devotee. Such is the attractive power of the Lord. Now, so many times, if I'm remembering my very initial years when I just came over here, and I mean, my parents used to be bewildered. Why do you go to the temple so often? I mean, they were worried that I was depressed or something like that. And I don't know what was pulling me, but it was just so attractive. And so many times, you know, even I've heard from different parents that children are like, you give them a choice, you know, you want to go here, you want to go there, and they say, I want to go to the temple. And we don't know what's happening, but, you know, all the different psychological faculties are getting so satisfied when we come to the temple. We are not able to perceive what is attracting us, but it is very attractive. And that is why, you know, even a person who's so self-satisfied on that platform can become attracted to Krishna, and thus Sukadeva Goswami. So the attraction is so powerful that a pure devotee never hankers for any of the four principles of religion. So by interpreting each and every word of this shloka, one can see unlimited numbers of transcendental qualities of Lord Krishna that attracts the mind of a pure devotee. So this verse is also a very important verse. It's called the Atmaram shloka, and it gives the explanation as to why Sukadeva Goswami gets so attracted to, you know, hearing the Srimad Bhagavatam and then speaking the Srimad Bhagavatam like that. Now the next section is sections 12 to 40, and Arjuna captures Ashwatthama. And we have a lot of story here going forward, the end of this chapter. So Suta Goswami thus addressed the rishis headed by Shaunaka. And like, now I shall begin the transcendental narration of Lord Krishna and the topics of his birth, activities and deliverance of King Parikshit, the sage amongst kings, Raj Rishi, as well as topics of the renunciation of the worldly order by the sons of Pandu. So in the fourth chapter, the rishis are asked about Maharaj Parikshit. And you may wonder, like, why suddenly, you know, Suta Goswami was talking about, you know, Vyasadeva's meditation and this and that, and now he's suddenly talking about this. So he's trying to answer the question that the sages has put up. And also, like, in the verse it is said, in the text 12 verse, it is said, the last line of the verse is, Suta Goswami's words are Vakshye Krishna Kathodayam, words that give rise to speaking of Krishna Katha. So, you know, he's already gone through so many verses, so many chapters. He is also hankering to speak about the Lord, glorify his pastimes, glorify his activities, share it with the people at large. So his words are Vakshya Krishna Kathodayam, words that give rise to speaking of Krishna Katha. So thus Suta Goswami begins the story at the point of disaster, which is just after the battle of Kurukshetra. And this is the first time in his narration we will see Lord Krishna in action. We will get his darshan by his activities. So how is Lord Krishna introduced? So far we heard Satyam Param, he is the absolute truth. And then what happens when we offer service to the absolute truth? What happens when we perform, what is the potency that comes, you know, like what happens when you perform pure devotional service to the Lord? You acquire knowledge and detachment. So now we know we have an absolute truth. When we serve him, we get knowledge and detachment. But how, who is Krishna? Like, what are his qualities? You know, how do, like, who is he? What are his personal attributes? So the first introduction of Srimad Bhagavatam is Krishna is serving his devotee Arjuna as a chariot driver. So between chapters 7 to chapters 11, we see an intimate glimpse of Krishna interacting with his devotees. You know, all the different interactions he has with the Pandavas, with Kunti Devi, the reciprocations, with Draupadi, with Uttara, with also with the Dwarkavasis, you know, all those, and Bhishma Dev, like, Bhakta Vatsal attributes of Krishna, like, you know, all those very, very sweet and very, very beautiful and very, very personal pastimes of the Lord are there in these chapters. Because late, then, you know, after that, the second canto, third canto starts talking about the creation and the energy and all those things. It, you know, it's like the separate energies of the Lord. But here it is all about his intimate pastimes, so that we feel attracted to go to the 10th canto. So we go through the process that Srila Prabhupada has given, go through all the verses and then go to the 10th canto. So this is the most intimate glimpse we will see before the 10th canto pastimes. So I'll just get into a little bit of the story here. So Ashwatthama is the son of Dronacharya, and he's the opponent of the Pandavas. He kills the five sons of Draupadi in their sleep. You know, that's a break of religious principles. And then Draupadi is very, very sad. Arjuna gets very angry. He wants to, you know, to pacify her. You know, he vows to take revenge and bring the head of Ashwatthama to her. And then he, you know, he sits on the chariot and he tells Lord Krishna to take him over there. When he's taking him over there, Ashwatthama gets, like, you know, he starts running away, he starts to flee. And while he is fleeing, he sees that his horses are getting tired and Arjuna is coming with immeasurable amount of energy, and Arjuna doesn't seem to get tired, but Ashwatthama feels that his horses are getting tired. So in a bit to protect himself, he just, like, okay, what do I do now? I'm in danger, you know. Very, very material response. I'm in danger. What do I do? Okay, let me release the Brahmastra. I don't know how to release it, but at least it will solve my temporary problem. That's breaking of religious principles number two. You don't release a weapon that you don't know how to withdraw. So I was just thinking about it for myself. I should not release words that I don't know how to withdraw. And he realizes, then Arjuna realizes his life is in danger when he sees the Brahmastra approaching him. And one more thing is that what I read in Bhurijan Prabhu's book is that only the person on whom the Brahmastra has been released, only he can see the Brahmastra. So Arjuna can see the Brahmastra and you know, he doesn't know what to do. He knows his life is in danger. He immediately turns to Lord Krishna and, you know, we will get into the verses. I'm just giving you the synopsis of the story right now. He speaks very, very beautiful verses from which we can learn so many things. And then the Lord advises him to subdue it with the power of his own Brahmastra. And then the Brahmastra is subdued. Ashwatthama is captured. And Ashwatthama is brought. The Lord tells him, you know, kill him. It's not against religious principles. He's an aggressor. He's done this, this, this. You can kill him. But Arjuna, being soft-hearted, you know, he does not want to kill him. So he brings him to the camp. So then they finally bring him to the camp. And then Draupadi sees him. Like, look at this picture. She sees him. He's completely bound by different ropes. And so Draupadi feels a lot of compassion towards him. He's son of a Brahmana, son of our teacher. We should have gratitude. We should not behave like that. And then she requests him to release him. And she tells, don't kill. Then Nakul, Sahadev and Yudhishthir Maharaj, they agree with Draupadi. But Bhima is like, no, I'm going to kill him. I'm going to kill this guy. So in this picture, you see that Bhima is, like, all ready to kill him. And Draupadi is, like, trying to save. You know, she's trying to come in the middle and tell, you know, stop Bhima from doing that. And then Krishna tells Arjuna, look, you have to satisfy your wife. You have to satisfy me and Bhima also. So basically, Bhima and Krishna are telling that you have to kill. And then Draupadi is saying, don't kill. So Arjuna is like, okay, what do I do now? So Arjuna gets a middle ground. He humiliates, he's cutting off his hair and removing his jewel. And that is humiliation. Dishonor is worse than death. So he humiliates him. That is as good as death for him. And then everyone is satisfied. So Arjuna gets that instruction from Lord Krishna, does it, and everyone is satisfied. And Ashwatthama is released. And the Pandavas then they go back and they do discharge their duties. They're lamenting for all the countless family members, and they're offering like water to the Ganges for all the members departed. So what Prabhupada writes is that it's a practice that you take a pot of water, you go to the Ganges, you take a pot of water and you offer it to each of your deceased relatives. And they perform the funeral rites for their sons and relatives who had died in the battle of Kurukshetra. So another thing that happens here is that there is some, just touch upon it very briefly, is that all, they say that all the Pandavas, I mean the entire Kuru, now the Pandavas become the Kurus, so they all are going together and they are walking to the Ganges with the woman walking in the front. And then I was just thinking, there were these two opposing parties, they had a battle, they had a terrible war, people died on each side, but they are walking together. They're together as a family, walking together to offer, to offer water to their deceased. So, I mean, I was just thinking, okay, Gandhari lost all her sons, but she, and you know, because of Kunti's sons, but they're still walking together. And Dhritarashtra and Yudhishthir and everyone are serving Dhritarashtra also, even in spite of, you know, Dhritarashtra's different things that Dhritarashtra did. So I was just thinking that they're connecting on a very higher principle. And I found that to be something I should be applying in my life, is to connect on that higher principle and let all these bodily things go away, let all these material attachments go away, connect on that higher principle of the soul and, you know, do my service properly. If I have some differences with devotees or something like that, instead of focusing on the differences, I should just unite and do my services together. So now, completing the story here, we will move on to some of the lessons we learned from Arjuna, Draupadi and others. So how Arjun takes shelter of the Lord. And these verses are very, very beautiful. We can chant the two Sanskrits together. Krishna, Krishna, Mahabaho, Bhakta Naam Abhayankara, Tvam Eko Dahyamanam, Apavargo Si Sama Shrite, Tvam Adya Purusha Shakshad, Ishvara Prakrite Para, Mayam Vyudasaya Chitchaktya, Kaivalye Sthita Atmani. So Arjuna has this Brahmastra coming. If I just throw, someone throws a fiery ball at me, I'll be like, okay, how do I protect myself? But this is a Brahmastra, weapon of mass destruction, that is coming on to him. And in that situation, I mean, he's a very, very capable person. You know, he is the world's, best archer, so much ability to counteract that weapon. But he's praying, oh my Lord Shri Krishna, you are the almighty personality of Godhead. There is no limit to your different energies. Therefore, only you are competent to instill fearlessness in the hearts of your devotees. Everyone in the flames of material miseries can find the path of liberation in you only. So Brahmastra is like flames of material miseries. We are also facing Brahmastras all the time, but how many times am I taking shelter of the Lord? I feel I can fix it, I can deal with it, I can figure it out, I can solve the problem. Krishna has given me the intelligence, so my duty is to use my intelligence. No, my duty is to use the intelligence to take shelter of Krishna. So, but how many times am I doing it? And he's saying, you are the original personality of Godhead. So, who can give you fearlessness when fear personified is fearful of him, right? Only Krishna can give you fearlessness. So you are the original personality of Godhead, who expands himself all over the creations and is transcendental to material energy. You have cast away the effects of the material energy by dint of your spiritual potency. So if we situate ourselves in that spiritual potency, we will also be, you know, the Krishna will cast away the effects of the material energy from us also. You are always situated in eternal bliss and transcendental knowledge. So Arjuna is an accomplished archer. He could have depended upon his ability, which is a very false shelter, because the ability also comes from Krishna. Krishna can withdraw it any time when he's testing us to counteract the Brahmastra. But he depends upon the Lord and takes shelter of him. Now, so that is a very, very beautiful thing, contrasted with what Ashwatthama did. Oh, my horses are getting tired. Fine, let me release the Brahmastra. Did not take shelter. But Arjuna, most accomplished archer, knows that even the ability is coming from Krishna. So even if he has to act at that situation, he can only act if Krishna is giving him the ability at that point of time, you know, with that fearlessness and everything. So Krishna replies immediately. And the first words, these are the first words he speaks in Srimad Bhagavatam. They are not some big time heavy philosophy here. Very practical instruction to a devotee in distress. And he just tells him, you know, hey, you can only counteract it by, you release another Brahmastra, and that is the only way you can counteract this Brahmastra. Now, that's another lesson for us. So many times when devotees are in difficulty, are we giving them practical instructions or are we telling them, you're not the body, you're the soul? So that is another thing I learnt over here. because they first are looking to come out of that distress. So first we release them from that, then you can tell. So even when the relatives had all died, Krishna allowed them to lament, they all allowed them to do everything. But only after they had finished all that, that Krishna gave them the instructions. So now I was just remembering different things from Srimad Bhagavatam. The different examples of how the exalted devotees of the Lord take shelter of the Lord in the most difficult situation. They are not busy in counteracting and counter-cursing and doing all those things. They are busy taking shelter of the Lord. Now, Mother Yashoda, when she sees the universal form in Lord Sri Krishna's mouth, she falls to the floor. And, she has that affection for the child, and instead of trying to depend on her own ability as a mother to, remove whatever she sees, she probably sees some mud, she wants to remove it. She sees that this is beyond her conception, beyond her comprehension. And then she's praying to the Lord, oh Lord, you're the Almighty and I don't understand this, I should worship you, I should worship Nanda, I should worship everyone and I should falsely not think I'm a controller. So in that situation, when her child has something different going on, like imagine yourself, your child, you see something in the mouth. What is our reaction going to be? What is our reaction going to be when we are in a bewildering situation? For that, in that situation, Yashoda Maiya was a very bewildering situation for her. But she's trying to depend on the Lord. First, take the time to pray to the Lord, get His shelter, and then receive the instruction from Him and then act accordingly. Similarly, if you see, you see Lord Krishna's, so when such devotees surrender to the Lord and they show that dependency and they feel that dependency to the Lord, then the Lord will protect to the extent to which we are dependent upon Him. To the extent to which we are dependent upon Him, but to the extent to which we feel dependent upon Him, to we realize how dependent we are on Him. And then in the Govardhan Hill pastime, even the Vrindavan Vasis, they are completely dependent on the Lord. Any difficulty, they're just going to Krishna, help us. And that verse also, when the Govardhan, when there's so much rain happening, the first line of that verse also is Krishna, Krishna, Mahabhaga. Oh, the most opulent one, the most fortunate one, please protect us. And then they are going and trying to take shelter from the Lord. And then look at what goes on in the Lord's mind. Look at what feeling He has towards His most, the dependent devotees. He says, I must therefore protect the cowherd community by my transcendental potency, for I am their shelter. So He has taken, He'll take responsibility to the extent to which we show we are, feel dependent upon Him. I am their master, and indeed they are my own family. After all, I have taken a vow to protect my devotees. He would have protected Ashwatthama also, but Ashwatthama did not want protection. So then Krishna is a person, right? If someone wants help from us, we will go and help. But someone does not want to receive help from us, we are not going to, even if we want to help. But we know that if we go and help, they're not going to take. So it's not going to work out, right? So even Krishna is a person. Now contrast that with Gajendra. Like Gajendra also, when he struggled for 1,000 years with the crocodile, the struggle, so many of his, so much cleaning up happened, right? He understood, oh, the family is fallible, this is fallible, that is fallible, He had 5-star vacations. He used to be in that, the lake description is very beautiful, that area. We go to such resorts to go on a vacation. So he had those 5-star vacations for him. He had wine, women, wealth. He had power. When he would go and sip water over there, the tigers and everyone would go away, the deers would go away, out of respect for him, that no, we should leave the lake for Gajendra. Such a powerful person for 1,000 years, what happens is he realizes all these 5 things that he has are fallible. They're not his shelter. And he gives up. That is the purification that happens over 1,000 years. And the minute he takes shelter of the Lord, the Lord is there to him. So it is that instant. It is that instant when we express our dependency to the Lord, we realize our dependency to the Lord, the Lord is going to be there for us. For 1,000 years, the Lord did not come. Because Gajendra was trying different things. So, but he came immediately, and then very beautiful prayers were offered by Gajendra. He says that my body is covered with ignorance and I'm gradually trying to get out of it. Please have mercy on me. I am like this. What to do? Help me. So he's humble, right? So for us also, that is a lesson. The minute we show our dependency to the Lord is going to be there for our protection. But how much can we break through our false ego to go get there is the question. So, and then Krishna is going to give us very practical instructions. Krishna is not going to tell you at that time, you're not the body, you're the soul. Of course, He will create the situations to make us understand that, but He is going to protect us. So, The next lesson is Draupadi is giving six reasons for not killing Ashwatthama, and I just put the verse numbers down and go through this quickly. She cites piety, reason and justice, kindness and humanity, mercy, equality and greatness based on willingness to show proper respect for a great family. So what are the lessons we learn from Draupadi based on the reasons she gives? So Draupadi has lost five of her children. She has lost five of her most dear children. They were killed in the most wrong manner. They were not given a chance to protect themselves. They were killed when they were sleeping. She lost her children. She's already in a very disturbed state because of the war and, you know, because of so much destruction and everything. She's in a very, like, already feeling a lot of pain in her heart. Plus, she lost five of her children. And in that situation, the person who killed her children has been brought in front of her. And in that situation, she is able to follow the customs. In that bewildered, in that disturbed, in that very difficult situation, very painful situation, she is able to follow the customs. If I am in any difficult situation, my first, I am just going to be absorbed in myself. I am just going to think about, oh no, what happened to me? Oh no, this happened, that happened. Like, you know, I am just going to be very, very disturbed, completely absorbed in my problem. I don't know how many such things I can follow. But if I am able to follow such customs and all, there, it's a protection for me. It's like the square in which, that gives me a square in which I operate so that I don't do sinful activities outside. I behave myself, I don't incur more karma. So in that difficult situation, she's following the custom. Like Prabhupada says, and even Burijan Prabhu says, that according to Shastric injunction, Ashwatthama could have been killed. So what she's following here is not a Shastric thing. She's not trying to follow Shastras here. She is following the custom, and the custom is that out of respect for the Brahminical order, she requests Arjuna to release Ashwatthama. One may say, Ashwatthama is not a Brahman. Why? No, he deserves to be killed. We should kill him. No, he is a Brahman. He is a Brahman Bandhu. He is associated with Dronacharya. He may not show the qualities, but he is a Brahman. How can I respect him? And in that situation also, she is feeling the... maybe I'll tell you a little story. I think of the one and only festival of inspiration I had attended. And many times the Mother's Day falls during the festival of inspiration. I think I attended one 5 years ago. And it was a Mother's Day talk. And the talk was, I don't remember who gave the class, but I think it was Rukmini Mataji. And after she gave the class, then everyone was glorifying, like, you know, other Prabhupada disciples were speaking about motherhood and the, you know, the glories of being a mother and the qualities of a mother. And Prithu Prabhu was talking about one story. And he is German, and he went through all the different experiences that all the Germans went through during the Nazi rule. And I think one of his relatives, I don't know if it was his father or who, but maybe one of his brothers, someone in the family was killed because of this whole, the Gestapo police and everything they killed. And then they used to have guns in the house to protect themselves. So once that those people again came into their house, the Gestapo police, and they came into the house, they were ready to kill them and everything. But somehow Prithu Prabhu and his brother were ready with the guns, and then, you know, the tables turned and they could have killed the police at any time. And then his mother comes and tells, in that situation, she has had a major loss, either, too bad, I don't remember, does anyone remember? Okay, too, I don't remember, but I think it was someone very close in the family and she was feeling the loss, it was either her son or her husband. In that situation, she tells them, why do you want to do this? Why do you want them to suffer in the way in which we are suffering right now? Just let them go. And then Prithu Prabhu's, I mean, he's saying that, no, but me and my brother were like, no, we want to take revenge, we want to do this, we want to do that, but his mother said, no, don't do this. So this is the exalted nature that comes out. The greatness of a person has to be estimated by the ability to tolerate provoking situations. So it's not just tolerance, keep curve, but it's also about how we are behaving, how we are taking the situation, how we are being compassionate, empathic to the other person. So even in that situation, she's following custom. She also has tremendous amount of gratitude. Right? When someone, nobody is fully black. Right? There's always so many positive things that a person has, but in the difficult situation, we forget all the good that that person has done to us, and we only remember, but how could he do this? The good has no meaning. How could this person do all this to me? So in that situation, Draupadi does not forget the gratitude that Dronacharya is our teacher. Because of him, we could win the war, even if he was on the opposite side. But he taught all this. Arjuna was his favorite student. And Arjuna must feel obliged in the absence of the Acharya. And in the absence of the Acharya, his son is a representative. Because Kripi did not go through Sati, because her son is still there. So that means the representative is still there. We cannot kill the representative. And we don't want to insult a family that is respectable and worshipable. So those are the reasons. And then she has empathy. She's not a tit-for-tat person. She's feeling that if, you know, this happens to Ashwatthama, if we kill him, what will his mother go through? Do I want someone to go through the same thing that I am going through? No. So just like I was just thinking about it, and I thought that when there is a war of words, and if someone is saying something to me, it hurts my heart, then I want to hurt their heart again by saying something back to them. But if I learn something from this, it is, no, I went through this pain. Someone, you know, so why do I want the other person to go through this pain? And the war of words is small, but imagine, she's lost her sons. And every Shastric injunction says that Ashwatthama can be killed. So even if she allows him to be killed, she's not going to incur anything. But still, she's taking the higher ground. And it is very difficult to empathize with the person who has caused difficulty to us, or with the associates of the person who has caused difficulty to us. But in that situation, she is empathizing with Ashwatthama's mother. But empathy and forgiveness comes when we are able to tolerate the situation. When we are in acceptance that, okay, this is Krishna's plan, this is Krishna's mercy. If we situate ourselves like that and we think, this is Krishna's plan, this is Krishna's mercy, let me just do service now. That is my job, because I am a servant. I may be a mother, I may be a this, I may be a that. All those designations are getting hurt by all those actions. But I am a servant, I am none of those things. So let me not get offended here. Let me just offer my service. Let me tolerate the situation. So when we are able to tolerate, automatically the other qualities also come up. Forgiveness, gratitude, empathy. We are able to situate ourselves like that. So next reason she says is that an offense to a Brahmana can destroy everything. So she's like, we fought this war, we got everything. We are supposed to lead the countrymen now. We are supposed to lead the people here now. And we commit an offense to the Brahmana. What example are we setting for other people? So she is behaving on a responsible platform. This reminded me of a story in the Srimad Bhagavatam. So Indra does not, I think most of you have heard, right? Indra does not, like once he's in his palace and then his guru comes, Brihaspati comes, but it's not Indra's, like it's just a second. It happens in a few seconds. That happens to me all the time. But over there, it becomes an offense. He does not get up to receive Brihaspati properly. Right? He is engrossed in watching the dance with his wife. And then he does not get up to receive Brihaspati properly. And then Brihaspati just walks away. Indra immediately realizes, I made a mistake. But Brihaspati just disappears. He does not give Indra a chance to come and ask for forgiveness, because there is a future plan of the Lord. So that is the first offense he does. He realizes, he feels guilty. Oh my God, I made an offense to my guru. I committed this offense. I should not have done that. He's going through all those emotions. He's feeling, genuinely at that time, he's feeling very, very sad. And then because of offense to the guru, the demons become more powerful. Because they lose all their, because he has offended his guru, then all their abilities and everything go away. Because all those abilities come only by the mercy of the guru. So the demigods become very weak, and the demons become powerful because they are serving Shukracharya very nicely. They are satisfying the guru very nicely. Demons become very powerful. War is happening. Demigods are losing every battle, getting cut, being thrown here and there. And then, so then they go to Brahma, you know, please help us, what to do and everything. So then Brahma says that, okay, you go to Vishwarupa, he will create a Narayan Kavach for you. You all wear that, then you all will become powerful. And Brahma says, because you offended your guru, you are suffering. They are serving the guru nicely, pleasing him, they are powerful. So then they go to Vishwarupa and they pray and everything. And then Vishwarupa is a young person. Demigods are very accomplished. They go and they are bowing down to him, we accept you, please, you know, help us and everything. Fully surrendered, very nicely. Vishwarupa gives them he prays, makes the Narayan Kavach, tells them what mantras to chant and where all to put it, how to do it. Then they do that. Then one time, they're very friendly with Vishwarupa, a lot of gratitude. One time, Indra sees Vishwarupa is offering oblations to the demons, because one of his ancestry line is of the demons. So he's seeing him offering oblations as a matter of custom. And then Indra gets very offended, finished. I don't care what you did to me, I'm going to kill you. Cuts Vishwarupa. Second offense. think about it, he offended Brihaspati, is apologizing, sorry, he went through so much suffering, gets Vishwarupa's help, again he creates does an offense to Vishwarupa, so lesson not learnt. Then Vishwarupa does that, and then the demigods become powerful at that time again, and then they are asked to go to Dadichi, and then Dadichi is another Brahman, he tells him, give me your bones, I need to make a thunderbolt. So Dadichi, someone asked me to do such service where I have to give my life, I will not do. But Dadichi feels that, okay, you know, this is giving me liberation, I'll give up my body, I'm done. It liberates me from everything. Dadichi says, okay, you take the bones. Taking service from such an exalted Brahman, another offense. Takes his bones, he has a thunderbolt. But then the demigods get very offended, then they create this Vritrasura. You know the Chitraketu story. So then Vritrasura is created. So already three offenses have happened. We have not learnt anything so far. We are saying sorry, but we have not learnt anything. Then he starts fighting with Vritrasura, and then he wants to kill Vritrasura also. And Vritrasura is just doing it as a service to the Lord, because Vritrasura feels, okay, whatever he wants to do, I am doing service, even if I am on the demon side or whatever side. So like that, repeatedly, Indra is not learning the lesson. Indra is a great devotee of the Lord, and this is just pastimes for us to learn. But why is this? Because there's too much attachment to material opulence and power, and the fear of losing it causes us to cause so many offenses. Indra did not want to lose to the demons. He did not want to lose his fame, opulence, his power and everything. So that's why repeatedly, even if he wanted to, he was coming back to Sadgun, you know, trying to behave properly, understanding his, I should respect. But then that the snake of attachment to power and opulence would come up again, and then to satisfy that, he would have to again, he was again behaving in different ways. So that is what happens when we are too attached to material opulence, power. The fear of losing it blinds us from duties, customs and religious injunctions, which is not the case in Draupadi, which is not the case for Draupadi. That's a very exalted position. So gratitude helps us tolerate and protects us from committing offenses. There's one lecture by Radhanath Maharaj, and the title is Gratitude is the Womb of Humility. So gratitude is very important, and we must aspire to become forgiving like Krishna. He forgave Lord Brahma when he stole his dearmost cows and gopas. I mean, that is very, very dear to Krishna, but he stole them, but still forgave them. Indra caused so much problem to all the Vrajvasis, but Krishna forgave them. And Shiva, in the pastime of Daksha and Shiva, there's a verse which says there is so much cursing and counter-cursing going on between them. That Shiva, it all started because, but Shiva just goes away from there. He feels, why should I get involved in this? Let me just go away from there. He's a true Vaishnava. He just forgives and moves on. So that, otherwise, if go on into that, it entangles us. And even Draupadi, like how she is forgiving here. So that is a very, very important thing I desire to aspire for by all of your blessings. And then Rupa Goswami says that Krishna perfectly exemplifies the qualities of a forgiving person, is a person who tolerates all kinds of offenses of the opposite party, because he is self-satisfied, does not need anything, his only job is to help them. So, yeah, we finished chapter 7 summary, and so what we just learned, we heard about Vyasadeva's meditation and what he sees based on which he writes Srimad Bhagavatam, and the next section is about why an Atmaram like Sukadev Goswami is also attracted to the verses of Srimad Bhagavatam. So what is our responsibility? Then the next section is about how Ashwatthama is captured, and then how he is forgiven by Draupadi, and the exalted qualities of Arjuna and Draupadi. So moving on to the next chapter 8 summary, just a minute.